Hello and welcome to another episode of the Men with the Golden Tongues. I am your host, Micah, joined again by my co-host, Brad.
So, you were just in Jamaica.
Yes.
A locale that has James Bond lovers, fans, that is important in the James Bond mythos.
Yes.
I have to ask you, did you have any nights at your hotel where deadly spiders were crawling up your bedsheet? And did you check? I'm assuming you checked. One assumes that you looked out for these things.
Yes, because my wife has a hyper case of arachnophobia. Like, it is not even funny. Like, she's just like, let's close the curtains in the windows because we're on the third floor. But, you know, in case any critters come in, and I'm like, we'll be fine. We'll be fine.
And while your hair is very closely cropped, I would assume that you took a piece of your wife's hair every time you guys left the hotel room and spread it out across the closet door to ensure that no spies were getting into your stuff while you were gone.
I really wanted to stay at GoldenEye,
mm-hmm.
but
that would have been very expensive.
Yeah, she said GoldenEye is damn near $400 a night on random days that we're going. So that's a no-go. I need you to get a better job. And then once you get a better job, then we can stay at GoldenEye. I was like, all right, you're right.
Did you get a chance to go to Crab Key while you were there?
No, we went to we flew into Montego Bay and stayed in Westmoreland. And I got to hold a marijuana plant, a real live marijuana plant.
That's not as impressive as you think it is. I guess it's impressive for you as someone who does not partake in these things.
But yeah, it was fun, and I'm glad I'm back, and I'm glad we're here today to talk about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, the fourth in the Tom Cruise Mission Impossible franchise. This film was directed by Brad Bird, produced by J.J. Abrams, Midlife Crisis Productions, Tom Cruise, and Brian Brooke. This film cost $145 million to make and made worldwide $694.7 million. That's a pretty big haul.
It's pretty good. And like we mentioned, that the third Mission Impossible film kind of started, kind of set the template for what the future films from there would be. And this is just a refinement, of sorts of the Mission Impossible template.
I like to think that Mission Impossible 1 is like the super hard hard espionage mm-hmm. take on a spy movie. And I guess some people were like, oh, I'm too stupid for this. We got to dumb it down a bit. And so Mission Impossible 2 was quite literally the dumbest of the dumb spy movies, but it was still a good time. Where Mission Impossible 3 kind of molded the two together, mm-hmm. I would say it's a little more on the two side than the one side. It is the mold with which we have finally tempered the Mission Impossible series to be what it is now, which is just a fun action series that doesn't take itself too seriously.
But still makes you think a little bit. Like, there's still a fair bit of intricacy in the plot in a Mission Impossible film.
When the things that they do take seriously, they take seriously, especially in this movie where there are quiet moments that feel incredibly tense. Like, I love a good silent, like, just spies doing their thing, and there's a bunch of fucking tension in the room, and we don't know if we're going to make it or complete our task or whatever. And this has a couple different, this movie in particular has a couple different scenes like that.
I think this film ratchets up the tension to insane degree. So, like, the Mission Impossible series, to be clear, is the series filled with where the heroes come up with a really good plan, but then, of course, the monkey wrench always kind of gets thrown in the middle of that plan, and they have to kind of improvise, or they have to regroup and shift a little bit. But this film specifically, this is like the Murphy's Law version of Mission Impossible. Like, everything that could possibly go wrong with everything that they do in this film goes wrong. Like, it's constantly worst-case scenario all the fucking time. The other, I wouldn't call it an issue that this film has, but arguably the stakes in this movie, like, you can't get higher stakes in a film, in Mission Impossible. Like you can only go down from here. It's not ridiculous. It's not as ridiculous as James Bond going to space, but it's that level of stakes in this film, considering what's on the line if these guys fail.
Yeah, the Marvel Universe took a decade to get to this point. and 11 movies to get here. But no, like, we're here, you know what I mean? And the movie does, so the villain is crazy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's a lunatic. And the movie, normally I don't care for this when the movie kind of calls itself out on its own bullshit. one of the characters is like, this guy was kind of booted out of his organization because he's a psychopath. And, he's a psychopath. And we just accept it. Like, I mean, but is, I don't know. But this movie is fun, man. I watched this movie twice before preparing because I really, really enjoy this movie and the next movie. These are my two favorite.
That's interesting. In the franchise. That's so interesting. So I really liked this film when it released, because when it released, it was definitely the best of the Mission Impossible franchise to that point. Through no fault of its own, it has plummeted down the rankings for me just because the next two films that follow it crapped all over this film.
Well, look, 5 is the best.
Yeah. We're in agreement on that for sure.
Yeah, 5 is the best. I need to see Fallout again.
I think you're going to rank it above this once you see it again. And I actually like 1 more than this one as well. If I'm being honest. Like if I'm being dead honest, I think I would put 1 above this one also. We'll talk about the reasons why as we go throughout the film. A lot of them focus around Jeremy Renner, who I don't care for very much.
Yeah.
Who they envisioned as kind of like the replacement for Tom Cruise eventually, as if Tom Cruise is going to stop doing Mission Impossible films. He has the Scientology blood in him. He can keep doing these until he's 80.
Yeah. I mean,
and he will.
He might be 80 right now. Who knows? Nobody really knows. He's an actor. He's a professional liar. look, this movie opens up with Agent Sawyer from Lost on a mission, and I forget his name is Josh
Holloway. Yeah,
this guy is really like kind of hamming it up when it comes, not hamming it up, but he's very much into this role.
Oh, he sounds like he's doing like the like they could have gotten Henry Cavill for this role. Like, he looks like he sounds like he's doing a Henry Cavill impersonation, like, of Henry Cavill's character in Mission Impossible 6.
Yeah, it's almost like a parody of just like the hyper straight-laced agent. You know, like, no, he's by the book. He's all business. He's Cyclops, you know what I mean? He's like, I need to target people. I can't look at all these other people. What, like he sounds like a black man's impression of a white man. You know what I mean?
like the Dave Chappelle white guy, essentially.
Right, right.
There you go.
Well, he's murdered. We come to him in the middle of his mission, and he steals
a messenger bag from a guy getting off of a train who we don't know what that person has or what he's carrying. We just know he's a target. And then as he's going down an alley, he sees a woman coming towards him, Lea Sado from Spectre, as it were. And then he gets a message perhaps 2 seconds too late from Assassin Tinder, letting him know that he probably should have swiped right. I don't know which way you swipe on Tinder. I've never had to use it before, but apparently he gets a message from Assassin Tinder letting him know that the woman that is coming toward him is an assassin. But of course, as soon as he sees the message, she has a gun and kills him, shooting him like 6 times. And of course, she turns the corner and leaves the alley right as his team is able to catch up with him just to watch him die, essentially.
Yeah, that sucks, man. Like, you gotta talk to your cell provider to try and get you those messages quicker.
Well, what happened is, so he had that like contact lens in where he could like scan faces, and apparently when he looked at her, the face, like the software recognized her as an assassin and went to let him know. But once you see the assassin, of course, it is too late to do anything about it.
This is a failure on technology, as far as I can tell. this ancient technology of this contact lens that beams information from a satellite to your phone, it needs to be better.
It does. But she takes the messenger bag with her as well. So this dude's dead. The mission is blown, and this mysterious assassin has whatever it was that he was trying to get.
We cut to a prison cell in Moscow, and we see a figure laying on a bed, throwing a rock at a wall that I guess is made of vibranium, because it's he's throwing it and catching it like he's Captain America, right? Like that always bothered me, right? Like that's just CGI for like CGI's sake, right? Like just throwing this rock and it's ricocheting off 2 corners and then he's catching it and he's doing it multiple times. I don't know. Like, I get it, right? You're super agent, right? I get it. You're perfect. But no, it just bothered the hell out of me. Well, it turns out that guy is Ethan Hunt, our protagonist. Long-haired Ethan Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with long-haired Ethan Hunt, you know, some shit is about to go down.
That's absolutely correct.
So he is incarcerated. And all of a sudden, all the prisoners are being let out. You see this incredibly easily hackable prison is being hacked by Benji, and he's working with another agent named Carter, Jane Carter, played by Paula Patton. And all of the doors are being opened to create a distraction for Ethan. So Ethan is trying the plan is for Ethan to escape. And Ethan is like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I've got my own agenda. I'm going to go and find my boy Bogdan. And
it is pretty funny. So like he's the goal is for Cruz to just get out, or for Ethan just to get out through this door that Benji opens. And he's like, I gotta go get this dude. So he's standing at this locked door right outside like the guard post. So he can't talk to Benji. Like Benji can just see him on the security camera, and he's trying to convey to him, like, come on. And Benji's like, no, I'm not opening the door. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you got to get out of here. So Cruz just, like, sitting there, like, basically looking like Sonic the Hedgehog, like, tapping his watch, like, tapping his foot, like, waiting for this shit to happen. Like he's looking at the, like, the guards are, like, looking at him, like, what the fuck? And he's just like, nah, what are you going to do? It's fucking weird. It's actually a very whimsical opening title sequence. I mean, you have fucking Dean Martin playing in the background. over the prison loudspeakers, just to cause as much havoc as they possibly can. It's a pretty funny opening sequence, considering.
Yeah, considering all the violence in here. I mean, like, if you think
that's the point. It's the juxtaposition of hearing this, you know, famous crooner singing "Ain't That a Kick in the Head" while there's a fucking prison riot going on, essentially.
Nobody ever thinks about, like, these prison guards, right?
No,
like,
these guys are going to be dead. Like there's so many prisoners.
These very innocent guys just going to do their job. And Benji is essentially releasing people that are going to murder them. Oh, sorry. Whimsical, innocent death. I don't know. I just, every time I see stuff like this, I'm just like, yo.
I like also how Ethan and Bogdan are like the only two normal looking people in this prison. And then anyone else is like Nathan Jones, basically.
Everybody else is a stuntman. and not just a stuntman, bodybuilding stuntman.
Right. Like, they're all humongous.
Just a bunch of ripped Russian criminals and skinheads. And Ethan is just beating the shit out of these guards. Ethan must have metal arms a la Jax from Mortal Kombat, because he's just punching these guards wearing helmets. At one point, Ethan is just like, look, open all of them because we got to get out of here. And Ethan and Bogdan, who is referring to Ethan as Sergey, is they head for the extraction point. They meet Agent Carter, and they get away, but not before Ethan says, light the fuse. That wasn't like a catchphrase.
Well, that, don't worry. Ethan Hunt will deliver a very corny catchphrase later in the film that the film will call itself out on, of course, as well. So. this is the first time we get like the spoilery title sequence in the Mission Impossible franchise, where you see the interstitching of things that will happen later in the film.
Are you a fan of that? I can't remember. There are a couple Bond movies that have done that.
Well, but Bond movies do it in a much more subtle fashion. Like, they do it with metaphors. Yeah. They don't do it with direct footage lifted from the movie that they splice in. I'm not terribly, like, miffed about it. Because, again, the first time you watch it, you don't know what the fuck any of that stuff is. Like, you just know, oh, they're going to be wearing formal. They're going to be at a party at some point, but we don't know where. And, oh, they're going to be at the Burj Khalifa, I guess, because we're going to see that landmark and stuff like that as well. So it's not terribly egregious, but I'd like it done with a little bit more of a deft touch, I guess.
Yeah. This is, like you said, this is literally just footage that they're reusing for the most part. And it is not even like incredibly like artistic. You know what I mean? Like, it's trying to be like a Bond opening, but it's not as artistic. It's not as clever. It's not, you know, this is literally just scenes that are going to be in the movie. And my thing is, I've already committed.
Right. I'm here sitting watching the film. Like, you don't have to get my buy-in.
You don't have to show the trailer for the film in the film.
Like, that's really what it is, isn't it? It also goes on unreasonably long. Why is the fuse that they set up so ridiculously long to have to go through all this? So that's fine.
Yeah. Let's see. Ethan is they get out, right? They get out, they let Bogdan go. And Ethan is recruited to lead the team of Jane Carter and Benji to infiltrate secret Kremlin archives.
The actual Kremlin, I have to point out. Like, one of the most secure fucking places on the planet Earth.
Yeah, why don't they just infiltrate the White House and get, you know, the secret Declaration of Independence underneath the White House? Like that's what this is the equivalent to. But, you know, like that Russian prison that was 100% hackable.
Right.
This is nothing for the Impossible Mission Force.
Welcome back, Mr. Hunt. In your absence, IMF has learned that Cobalt is or was a level one nuclear strategist for Russian intelligence. Therefore, the only way to uncover his actual identity is to infiltrate the Kremlin itself. In order to get past their checkpoints, you will be impersonating General Anatoly Fedorov. We believe Cobalt will do everything he can to destroy any record of his identity. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to penetrate the highly secured archive inside the Kremlin and retrieve Cobalt's file before he can destroy it. New intel suggests Cobalt is already en route leaving you
4 hours, 52 minutes
to infiltrate. To save time, we've chosen your team for you. Agents Carter and Dunn. As always, should you or any member of your team be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Ethan.
And in the meantime, Carter talks to Ethan about the last job and you know, what they were looking for and the fact that, so apparently she led the op, and what they were trying to get were these Russian nuclear launch codes that this guy was carrying. And it's weird because so she's leading that op, but then throughout the rest of the movie, she's kind of portrayed as this kind of raw, somewhat inexperienced agent in some ways. Like, they have to keep telling her, like, don't kill the assassin when we come across her. Like, you know, you need to have confidence in your abilities. Like, is she supposed to be like a young agent, or is she supposed to be just shook up really badly because of how sideways the previous mission went?
Woman. Nah, I'm just playing before anybody fucking gets this shit. I'm just playing. I think it is that she is, this was her first, I assume that this was her first op that she was leading, and it spectacularly failed. So maybe she's, you know, a little shaken up by it. That's why they have Ethan being the leader of this op, right? Mm. I don't know how seniority works in the Impossible Mission Force, but that's what I took from that. Okay. That's, yeah, I think Paula Patton is an okay actress.
I don't know her from anything but this. Like, I don't remember seeing her in like anything else.
She's been in like a bunch of black comedies and stuff like that. So it's not. It's not, she's not the best, but she's serviceable. Mm-hmm. This is the only thing like action oriented that I've seen her in. And I'll talk about that, a little later. Mm-hmm. Cause I got a weird, like not personal hang up, but it's me, you know, my hang up. But yeah, they have to infiltrate the Kremlin. So Ethan is like, hey, Ethan is told he's going to, impersonate this guy that looks just like Tom Cruise with a mustache, and Benji will be with him.
It's fortunate that Ethan Hunt happens to look like a lot of important people. Like, he just happens to look like a United States, like a senator in the first film. And now he looks pretty much exactly like a Russian general in this movie. So very, very coincidental and convenient for the Impossible.
The ultimate point of the Mission Impossible films is a commentary on the fact that white people all look alike.
Right, because they don't have a mask, because they don't have time to actually get a mask together. Because from the time they get the phone call, they're like, literally, hey, you have to go infiltrate the Kremlin, and you have to do it within the next 4.5 hours, because we think this guy is going to steal these nuclear launch codes from the Kremlin as well.
Yeah, no break. No, you know, like, they got Bogdan out, and then, like, they went to grab some lunch at Panera or something like that, and then bam, like, here's your mission. Like, do these guys get downtime?
No. We got to go to the Kremlin, baby. We got to get some codes. There's this crazy man that wants to steal them first.
Hey, while you're there in Moscow, do you think you could just swing by the Kremlin and break into it and then grab these codes for us? Okay. Apparently. So Ethan is recruited to lead Jane and Benji to infiltrate the secret Kremlin archives and locate files identifying Cobalt. This is related to, like you said, the mission that Jane let fail. This mission is one of the scenes I'm talking about where there's like a perfect use of silence while trying to infiltrate these secret archives. So they use this, there's this long hallway
I love this fucking thing.
And they throw up this like screen that projects the image of the hallway, but they can push the screen so that the person sitting at the end of the hallway will only see
because there's a camera on a boom arm that's attached to the back of the screen that is following the eye tracking of the person who you are trying to fool, essentially, so that it basically adjusts the image in real time so that it always looks like that the hallway is just the hallway and not a projector screen that is slowly moving towards the target. This is easily the most reverse engineered gadget in the history of anything that we've ever talked about on this show. Like, we talked about the fact that the Buzzsaw Rolex is reverse engineered for the purposes of that movie. But you can see where they might create such a thing. Like, you can believe that such a thing might exist. This is literally, hey, there's this hallway in the Kremlin where the archives are that we might have to go down one day. So we need to create a screen that are the exact dimensions of the hallway. And we need to create a system that will track the eye movements of one guard who sits at the end of the hallway so that we can move forward secretly in the hallway without him noticing us. And oh, by the way, can you whip up a directional microphone that when you click it makes it sound like a drip is happening so we can distract the guard to set up the screen first? Someone in R&D would be like, this sounds implausible. Why would we make this? But fortunately, there was one guy in R&D at the Impossible Mission Force that says, yes, this is something that needs to be made. I will make other screens that are the exact dimensions of other hallways in case we need to do the same thing in other buildings down the road.
Oh my God. This is the most outlandish piece of just nonsense movie technology I've ever seen.
By the way, it's a good thing that the hallway happened, that the dimensions of the hallway happen to be the exact aspect ratio needed that's filmed by the camera in order to project the image correctly on the screen without it looking stupid.
Good, you can't think about it.
Thank God we have a great 4x3 hallway that we have to put this camera down. The walls are straight. There's no like chair rails running down the sides or, you know, no dips in the carpet at all. There's no ornamentation on the ceiling. It is Russia after all, so everything's going to look plain and boring. Yay, communism. But, you know, it's, you know, that's what an amazing gadget.
Like what? this type of technology, like, why are these missions impossible? Right. Yeah, I need an invention that will let me do whatever I want in any situation. Here's a briefcase. Like, oh, all right, great.
and yet they still manage to almost fuck this up by Simon Pegg not paying attention that his face is like on the camera. So like when the guard looks down, like there's his giant face until Tom Cruise realizes it and gets him out of the way.
Oh shit.
But like you said, silence is used very, very effectively. I do appreciate the fact that the guard in the scene, it has the problem that all of us have, like when someone is near you and you can't see them, but you definitely know that like someone is around you, like you have that sixth sense around you that everybody has, that you can tell that somebody is near you, like you can feel kind of their presence. Yeah, I guess we all are innately imbued with the force in that way. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, yo, something ain't right. Right. Something's not right. I mean, of all things, right? Like, I don't know. So they push this thing down the hall to get to an area between the end of the hall and the guard, right? And they go in, and Ethan is looking for his stuff. And it turns out somebody beat him to the punch. And someone broadcasts across the IMF frequency, alerting the Russians to Ethan's team, the bad guy. And the bad guy is like, hey, team leader, are you ready to blow up the Kremlin? Because I got the stuff. And everybody's like, oh shit, what's going on? Abort, abort, abort. The hallway screen projector starts glitching.
Right, because tons of guards like storm the hallway.
Right,
and the camera
can't
know
whose eyes to look at. Right, this technology doesn't know whose eyes to look at, so it's looking at everyone. And then they run, and they're like, "Oh shit, it's a fake wall." So Ethan does what Ethan does best and start running through catacombs as this Russian dude, and he makes it out. He makes it out. He flips his jacket over. I do not believe that tight fitting officer's jacket, when reversed, becomes a bomber jacket. But
I also like he was able to like tear away the stripes on his pants so that it looks like he's just wearing like regular pants, and he's got like a Bruce Springsteen T-shirt on underneath.
Yeah, just to let you know, American like joke.
I'm super American, guys.
Right.
Allow me to put on my aviators while wearing my bomber jacket with my Springsteen T-shirt to show you how American I am.
So he gets out, right? But all of a sudden, boom, the Kremlin is blown up. And Ethan does what he does. He outruns this explosion. Well, but
for a time. The shockwave gets him eventually, so.
I love how that's just like, well, I guess that's anybody's instinct. But it seems to be Ethan's instinct in any situation, right? Like, hey, Ethan, we gotta climb up the Burj Khalifa. Like, let's start running. Like, all right. I mean, I don't think that's gonna work, but okay.
Ethan's wife throws him a surprise party. All of a sudden, everyone's like, surprise! And then they're like, they look, he's halfway down the block, just like running away from the situation.
Like, surprise! Hey, great! I gotta run to the Quickie Mart to meet an agent. I'll see you later. So he gets knocked out by the explosion, and he wakes up, and Ethan knows Russian, but we don't. So the movie plays Russian, a Russian news channel, and shows Russian subtitles that magically transform into English. I guess that's just to show us that he knows Russian. Right?
I believe that is correct. Yes.
Okay.
It's kind of like when you're playing No Man's Sky and you don't the alien language pops up on the screen, but then as you learn words in the alien, like they'll just interstitch the words occasionally for the things you know. So.
And so he wakes up handcuffed to a hospital bed, and all of a sudden. This Russian, I forget, SVR agent.
Mm-hmm.
What is service of? I don't know. He's like a Russian FBI guy named Anatoly Sidorov. He comes in.
And, yeah, it's basically Russian. He's a Spetsnaz agent, essentially. It's like you said, it's the FBI to the GRU CIA in Russia.
Right. He comes up and he's like. Yeah, we know you blew up the Kremlin because we got your frequency. So we know you're team leader, and you're going to pay for this. And I'm going to figure out, you know, how you did it. So he walks away, and there's something happens here that I kind of appreciate. Shows a little continuity between movies. Ethan reads these guys' lips.
Mm-hmm. In the third film. Yes, you're right.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, okay. You know, like these people have seen the previous movies. So Ethan decides, all right, it's time for me to escape, right? And I forget how he unhooks himself.
So the Russian agent is like getting ready to like be like, what the fuck? And then the nurse wheels Ethan into his room. And when she does that, she drops his chart on the gurney, and he, you know, stealthily takes the paperclip off of the chart while he's being wheeled in the hospital room, unseen by this Spetsnaz agent.
Ah, okay, all right. Ethan tries to escape by going out of a window, and then realizes, oh shit, I'm 50 feet up. And Anatoly is just like, yeah. So what you gonna do? Like Anatoly was just—he's
very amused, right? He's looking out the window. He's like, oh, that wasn't such a good idea. And Tom Cruise is like, oh, it seemed like one at the time.
And he's just loving it, right? Like, he's like, yeah, all right. He pulls out a cigarette, starts smoking, like, yeah, 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 come on back there, buddy. And Tom Cruise is like, I'm a crazy guy. I'm going to whip off my belt.
In one motion, too. Like, he fucking, like wrist flicks that thing and then flicks it over, like, a power line, essentially. I'm like, holy shit. Right.
Like, Jesus Christ, what is he, a black father about to beat his child? What the fuck? When'd you get them kind of skills, buddy? But he uses his belt to kind of zip line down a power line?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that's kind of dangerous.
A very conveniently placed power line at a very convenient angle to Ethan Hunt's needs for this specific situation. onto a bus, essentially.
So I think he robs a homeless guy of his jacket.
He does, and he steals boots off a table.
He goes to get to follow up on what he needs to do. We cut to a scene of this poor son of a bitch Russian guy, and he's like, he sees all this stuff on the news, and he's like, he goes to his wife and he starts speaking in English to her, and he's like, yeah, we should probably get out of Russia. And their son is like, why y'all speaking in English? I just found that kind of funny. And he's like, yeah, we gotta get out of here, because bad stuff is about to happen. And the dude walks away for a second. He comes back, and oh shit, our bad guy has this dude's family at gunpoint. And the bad guy's like, yeah, we got work to do, bro. We find out who that guy is a little later. Ethan is put in contact with the secretary of the IMF. They try to extract him out of Moscow. He meets with the secretary and with IMF agent Brandt.
Analyst Brandt.
Yes, sorry. IMF analyst Brandt.
Yeah. Bit of a guest appearance here for Tom Wilkinson. As the IMF secretary. Very impressive performance by him. He manages to effortlessly float between two different accents despite only 3 minutes of screen time in the film.
So Ethan is in the car, and he's like, yo, what's going on? And Tom Wilkinson is like, yeah, you've been disavowed. The president has introduced ghost protocol. And basically you're disavowed.
You have to alert the Kremlin that one of their strategists has a nuclear launch device, and one of his operatives has the codes to activate it.
And what makes you say that?
I saw him leaving the executive armory bag in hand. He set off that explosion to cover his tracks. It could be weeks before the Russians know what's missing, unless we tell them.
They won't listen to us. As far as the Russians are concerned, we just bombed the Kremlin. The tension between the United States and Russia hasn't been this high since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the blame, right or wrong, points to IMF. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed.
So what happens now?
Now I've been ordered to take you back to Washington, where the DOD will label you as a rogue extremist and hang the Kremlin bombing on you and your team. Unless you were to escape somewhere between here and the airport, having assaulted Mr. Brandt and me.
Sir?
You would then illegally scrounge whatever material you could from a backup supply cache that I've overlooked, the same cache where your team are waiting for further orders.
Sir, you may want to read.
You will then disappear, and this conversation never having taken place, your intentions would be unclear. But if any one of your team is caught or killed, they will be branded terrorists out to incite global nuclear war. Your mission, should you choose to accept it,
It'd be a real shame. It'd be a real shame, Ethan, if you overpowered myself and agent analyst Brent. And it'd be a real shame if you went to the train tracks to find the secret stash of the secret cache of weapons. It'd be a real shame if you met your team there. It'd be a real shame if you continued your mission. And Brant is like, yo, what? Like, what are you doing, yo? And Ethan is like, yeah, that'd be a real shame. It'd also be a real shame if somebody shot you in the fucking head right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, what the fuck, by the way? Like, I get it's Russia and, you know, the government, it's the shitty shit going on. Spetsnaz being able to murk a fucking, like, high-ranking American cabinet secretary seems like a little bit of a stretch.
It seems like a bit of a stretch, and it seems like, I don't know if it's just dumb luck or plot luck, mm-hmm. but he's able to headshot the secretary.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Right, like, right in the middle of the forehead. But Ethan and Brant are just, who are literally 3 feet in front of and beside of, and just like, nah, I'm just going to miss them. Yeah, they, like, oh, so Tom Wilkins' character is dead. The secretary is dead. The driver is dead. And Brant and Ethan have to figure out a way out. So they're over near some sort of, like, river, and the car falls into the river, and the Russian dudes are just shooting away, right? And Ethan takes a flare that was in the car, and he sticks it on the driver, and he lights the flare, sticks it on the driver, floats him away, and it draws the fire of the other guys. Now, I don't know if this is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this would work in real life, and neither does analyst Brant. So when they get up, they're like, Brant's like, yeah, but how did you know that would work? And he was like, I didn't know. I was like, but why did you do it? Because I had a hunch that it would work. What was your hunch? What led you to think that those guys? And then Tom Cruise is like, look, stop thinking. Okay. Okay. Audience. I mean, Brant, stop thinking. It worked. I had a hunch. These guys aren't Rhodes Scholars, man. Like, just go with it. I'm like, all right, I get it. Go with it. Because there's going to be a lot more wacky shit. And if you get hung up on this, you're not going to have a good time. So Brant is like, all right, whatever, bro. I'll just roll with it. So they get to the train station after a slight piece of physical comedy. The trains are the cash is on a freight on the train, and the train is moving, and they have to kind of punch in the numbers while running to catch the train, and then they have to do a retinal scan while running to catch the train. Anything to keep Tom Cruise running, man. Anything to keep him running is all we need in this movie. Everybody meets up, right? Everybody meets up, and Ethan explains that, you know, we've all been ghosted, and I don't know why they call it ghost protocol if, you know, the big thing is,
like, right, you're going to be disavowed anyway if you get caught. Like, now, right. I guess you'll be extra disavowed.
Like, all right. Like, just call it Mission Impossible Disavowed or something. I don't know. I guess Ghost Protocol tested well. That sounds like a spy game that Obsidian would make. Ghost Protocol. So their team is blamed for the attack. But they still have to track down Cobalt, the bad guy. There's something that happens in the car that I just find fucking ridiculous.
What's that?
So Ethan is like, hey, you got a pen while in the car with the secretary?
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
And he says, you got a pen? He's like, yeah, I got a pen. So Ethan takes a pen and writes on the and starts drawing on the palm of his hand. He draws a picture of the dude that he passed, that the bad guy. He draws a picture of his face, and he's like, "Who is this?" And he looks at, he shows his hand to him. I'm like, yo, come on, man. This is ridiculous.
And it's like police sketch quality, basically.
Right. And it's stupid, right? It's stupid. But once again, the movie knows it's stupid. So Brandt is like, well, I mean, that's crudely drawn, but I know exactly who it is. you can't do something stupid and then call yourself out on it and then just, all right, whatever. We're having a good time. We're not thinking. We didn't know it was going to work. How did you know that was going to work?
Right. So Cobalt is identified as Kurt Hendricks, who is originally born in Sweden, but he's a Russian nuclear strategist, and his idea is for a nuclear holocaust to befall the world so that it can be built from scratch again. We're basically fucking doing the plot of Moonraker here, essentially. But it's a guy who's actually a serious fucking guy and actually has the means to get this done, unlike starting a new human colony on a spaceship somehow.
What does so this was essentially the one of the characters in Watchmen wanted to do this. Instead of nuclear war, he wanted to bring a Cthulhu monster to come in eliminate people, and then the rest of the people would unite to fight it, and then the world would be a better place because they would have something to unite against. This is kind of like the Thanos thing, right?
This is the Reapers. Like, this is the plot of a lot of different science fiction where you have to bring society, civilization down to the embers so that it can rebuild itself again. And then the cycle will continue.
This is just weird, man. I never understood. Well, I guess it's because I'm not crazy, but, but yeah, that's the logic. And yeah, this guy's crazy. Like, I think this is the only like full on wacky character that, like just straight lunatic character that is in this series. Yeah, I think
he's also the least personable of the villains in this entire franchise. He gets the least screen time of any of them. Yeah. He's almost just like a, I don't want to go as far to call it a cameo, but he's almost just like he's kind of there. Like, it's almost like the actual driving of the plot is centered around the impossible mission team and them overcoming obstacles as opposed to anything that Kurt Hendricks is doing. Like, he's moving the plot along by acting, but he himself is just kind of like almost along for the ride of sorts. Yeah. It's very interesting in that.
Yeah. Like, there's no one character that Ethan can, he does have like a mano-a-mano showdown, but it doesn't like you said, it doesn't feel like he's there because he has to be there for the audience to point at and say bad guy.
Right. But it's about
the journey.
Right. But yet he brings with him, like, if even one minor thing doesn't play out to plan in this film, or goes the way it goes, if they're off by like a second here, a second there, and I know that's the Mission Impossible franchise in general, but like, the world's going to end if that happens. And again, they're lifting plot points from like The Spy Who Loved Me here, like literal plot points. Like, they're just doing the 40 year later version of The Spy Who Loved Me, which is fine. But yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's just in the hierarchy of villains, he is not very memorable.
No.
But Hendricks used the Kremlin bombing to cover up the theft of the Russian launch control device, and now is planning to trade with Moreau, who is the female assassin from the first part of the movie who killed Sawyer from Lost. He's going to trade, that he needs to make a trade with Moreau at the Burj Khalifa. So the thing that Moreau stole in the beginning of the movie and the thing that Hendricks stole now, Hendricks needs both of those things. So he's going to trade some diamonds or whatever, because diamonds are a girl's best friend. I don't know.
I mean, she's a for hire killer. Like, that's the thing you have to remember.
Yeah. So they're gonna make this trade. Now, while they're in the car, they determine, okay, well, how do we get both of these things? We have to try and make this exchange happen without each party knowing who they're giving their information to, who they're giving their MacGuffins to. Mm-hmm. And so the exchange is going to be between Moreau and Hendrix's right-hand man, Wince Wistrom. And it's going to take place at the Burj Khalifa, which is still the tallest building in the world.
Yes.
Okay.
A massive hotel in Dubai is what the Burj Khalifa is.
Yes. Yes. It's not the tallest building. It's the second tallest building. The tallest building is the one from Skyscraper, which was 9 times as tall because The Rock has a small penis.
So in Skyscraper, they literally said that the hotel in Skyscraper was 9 times taller than the Burj Khalifa.
It dwarfed the Burj Khalifa.
You're kidding.
I wish I was. I really wish I was. I kind of want to see if I can find it, because it was something ridiculous. And it's just like, all right, dude. Like,
so the Burj Khalifa apparently is 2,722 feet tall, which makes it the tallest building in the world. That is about half a mile. That's very tall.
I think this one was like a mile or a mile and a half.
Okay.
So 3 times as
big.
That's
still ridiculous. That's still ridiculous.
Come on, man. Like, goddamn.
So
3,500 feet.
There you go.
That's what it was. 3,500 feet.
So now, as any of us know, if there's something really tall in a Mission Impossible movie, Tom Cruise is going to have to hang from it.
Yeah.
That's just the way it's got to be.
Yeah. He's going to have to do it, and he's going to have to do it for realsies. This franchise is known for its stunts, and particularly that the main actor is doing a fair number of these stunts. Mm-hmm. Now, he's doing them with the utmost protection.
Right.
Right. But he's doing them. Like, I forget what it is. He is outside of the Burj Khalifa. I don't know if it's as tall as, like, where he is where they say he is.
They said, according to the trivia for this movie, he is approximately outside of the tower at the 1,700 foot mark.
Yeah. Like,
in the tower.
Yo, come on, yo. Like,
Why does he have to climb the tower? Glad you asked. So apparently they need to be able to get into the server for the hotel so that they have security camera access. Very important that that's happening. And you can't just apparently remote into the server room. You have to actually do it manually, and you can't get to the server room from the inside of the hotel. It's only accessible from the outside of the hotel. So Tom Cruise has to use these very cool, like sticky gloves, essentially, like electromagnet gloves that allow him to stick to the side of the hotel. Only gloves, by the way. He doesn't have like any kind of things for his knees or his feet to do this free climb up this hotel.
Yeah, Tom Cruise pull-up game is amazing. Apparently. Get out of here.
So man. and they only have, by the way, like less than 30 minutes before the meeting is scheduled to take place when they come to this realization. So within a 30-minute time, Tom Cruise, they have to cut away a section of the window of this hotel. He has to free climb, I think it's 11 stories, and go over seven rooms to get to the server room. Which, by the way, of course, because again, this is the Murphy's Law Mission Impossible, one of the gloves, like, basically when the climb is starting, essentially shorts out. So he's doing this pretty much one-handed of sorts. He pretty much, like, also when he gets to the server room, he falls down as well. So, like, he has to climb back up again. It's very strange. But he gets in there, and of course, as soon as he gets into the server room, the other glove fails as well. So he now has to get back to the hotel room. And so how does he do this? Well, he ties a a cable around himself, jumps out the window, runs down the side of the hotel. He's tethered to the server room. And the cable is, of course, just too short for him to just walk into the window. So he's got to, like, swing himself like a pendulum along the side of the hotel, cut the line. And again, because this is the Murphy's Law Mission Impossible, as he almost falls in the window, he bangs his head against the top of the window. So Brant has to dive out the window to save him, and Carter has to grab Brant so that he doesn't go flying out the window as well. But they make it. And in the meantime, like, while they're all recovering from this near-death situation, Simon Pegg comes in the room. He had been frantically using this device to change the door plates on the hotel rooms outside of theirs so that they could renumber it so they could have the numbers be what they need them to be. And he's like, man, I worked really hard to do that. You guys are all sitting around, and I'm making this shit happen. I'm a field agent, guys. I'm a field agent.
Yo, I'm a sucker for stuff like this. I love it. It's so ridiculous. And like you said, every little thing that can go wrong. But, it's just fun, man. It's fun. Now
the other plot point here. So they have this. So the plan is to have Cruz to have Ethan Hunt and Brant meet with the assassin. They're going to get the codes from her, and they're going to put them into this, like, briefcase where they are. Brant's going to, like, read the codes. He has the kooky contact lens so that he can, like, take pictures of the paper. And what that's going to do is beam them to a printer that's built into a suitcase that Carter has, who's going to meet with Wistrom. But what's cool here is that they're going to when Brant takes the picture of the page, it's going to scramble the numbers on the page so that the codes that Wistrom is getting aren't the correct codes. They're going to be wrong codes. But then they realize quickly that Wistrom has, by using the security cameras, that Wistrom has the Russian scientist with him that can authenticate the codes. So they quickly realize, to much to Brant's dismay, that they actually have to give Wistrom the real nuclear codes, because that's the only way that this situation is going to work without it getting blown up.
Again, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. Like all of their meticulous last minute planning, they're like, nah, we have to throw it out the window because we got to give the guy the real thing, which leads to, a bit of a standoff. So everyone essentially plays their part. This is one of those scenes where it's another one of those quiet scenes where everything is incredibly tense and you're trying to figure out whether or not, who knows who, because they don't even know if these people have met yet.
Right. They're taking a chance that these people have never met face to face or know what each other look like.
Right.
Which fortunately for them, they haven't. So,
right. Everything, starts to go according to plan. The Wistrom, who was Hendrix's right-hand man, gets the codes, kills the Russian authenticator, and starts to leave. Moreau makes that Brant is an agent because she has incredible vision and sees the contact lens that, gives some sort of overlay to say that it is, in fact, a contact lens with, like, circuitry in it. She sees it and she's like, kill him, right? And big fight breaks out. And Paula Patton is like, oh, girl fight time. Now look, I am a firm believer that women can do anything that men can do. I 100% believe that. But it is just a little difficult for me to believe that women who look like Victoria's Secret models can fucking punch and kick and do this kind of, like, hardcore, like, just violent damage to each other. And I don't know if it's mainly because I don't like looking at women fight. Like, I don't enjoy watching women fight. Like, I know people get some sort of, like, weird kink out of it. Like, oh, they're going to fight and then they're going to take their clothes off and make out. And then they're going to make out with me. And they're like, no, yo, like, people fighting are fighting. But I don't know. It's just, it doesn't seem believable to me. I know that's ridiculous in this movie, that something like this doesn't seem believable, but I don't know. You know, I believe that Gina Carano can punch people in the face and it looked bad. It looked badass and shit. But Paula Patton, I don't know. I don't buy it.
Well, and it doesn't help that this fight, it wasn't very hard hitting. Like, it seemed much more choreographed than other fights you see in this film. For example, like in the last part of the film.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, God damn. But Moreau and Carter start fighting. Ethan is like, yo, I need her alive. Like, acknowledge that you heard what I just said. And she's like, yeah, whatever. She didn't say anything. Eventually, a window gets blown out.
Oh, no, this was the same window that they had to cut out so that Tom Cruise could climb the side of the hotel. Just they never put it back.
And Carter kind of donkey kicks Moreau out the building, which has got to be a horrible way to die, right? Like, that's a pretty tall-ass building, man.
It's pretty tall. I would imagine that it's possible you could pass out on the way down when you're that high up.
Let's hope so.
I mean, if not, like, as soon as you hit the ground, it's all over anyway. Like, you ain't gonna feel that. Like, you'll feel the first impact, and then the rest of it, you're done.
Yeah, like, I just, like, I don't know. Let's hope she kept her eyes closed, because I wouldn't want to, like, just seeing it coming in either direction, right? Seeing the ground or seeing, like, the hole, like, that I flew out of get smaller and smaller, like, oh, it's a horrible way to go.
Meanwhile, Cruz is chasing down Wistrom, and he almost gets to him, except all of a sudden, here comes,
comes Chekhov's Sandstorm.
Well, not even that, but the Spetsnaz agents catch up with him in Dubai somehow.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. How did they do that?
I don't know. Well, we find out later, I guess. I think he was laying the breadcrumbs because he wanted them to catch him doing something good, because otherwise it would be very difficult to believe the circumstances, what's going on. So I think he purposely led them there. It's just their timing was incredibly poor. How Spetsnaz agents, who are supposed to be domestic Russian agents, are allowed to be conducting operations overseas, I don't know. That's a bit of a logical fallacy, but what are you going to do? But yeah, so he gets away, he breaks the dude's nose, and is chasing down Wistrom. Unfortunately for Tom Cruise, they managed to find an actor who can run almost as fast as he can.
Well, the actor kind of had he had help.
He did.
He had help from a sandstorm.
Yeah. Speaking of things that are fucking terrifying, I'm never gonna go to the Middle East, because being in a sandstorm seems frightening.
Yeah, because it's like you can't see. Right. And it's not even like you can't see, like, it's not fog. You know what I mean? It's not a bunch of water vapor. It's sand.
Right. Hitting you in the face all around you.
Like, you need masks and goggles to get through it. But it is a cool little action scene. Tom Cruise has at the same time the best and worst GPS location in the world, because yes, it can see through a sandstorm, but like sometimes,
right? So, and we're like, it'll not work, and then all of a sudden it'll work, but only as the signal is like 50 meters away from you and barreling towards you at incredible speeds, because he's in a car and he's about to fucking plow you.
But look, I'll give this movie a lot of credit. There are set pieces that I've never seen before in movies. I don't really recall too many car chases in a sandstorm. I don't recall ever seeing a movie's climax end where this movie's climax ends.
True.
Yeah, I'll give this movie that. Like, as ridiculous as it is, it does become pretty inventive.
This car chase ends with Tom Cruise causing a head-on collision with the car that he is attempting to chase in the middle of the sandstorm.
Point of trivia, not the only head-on collision that Tom Cruise will be involved in this movie.
That's true.
He runs into the other car, right?
Now he bails before the collision happens because he knows it's coming.
Yeah, because the selective GPS selectively works now.
Right, but somehow, despite the fact that the other participant in the crash did not bail out of his car, he was still able to get out without seemingly much of an issue, it seems.
Yeah, because that car did a matchbox. Like, it flipped three times and hit the ground and flipped some more. I was like, Jesus Christ. And he just gets out. Now, you're going to have to explain something to me.
I don't know that I'm going to be able to. We'll see.
Wistrom gets out, and it turns out that Wistrom was actually Hendrix in disguise.
I have the same question. I don't know why he needed to double Wistrom to begin with, unless he didn't trust Wistrom entirely, I guess. Like if he wanted to make sure that he was the one that was overseeing the deal, but he didn't want to put his face out there. Like, I guess that's the only reason that you would need to do that. I feel like the movie only did it for that one scene when Cruise is like riding on the front of the car and he like reaches in and grabs Wistrom's face, but it comes off with part of his face because he's wearing a mask. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like that's the only reason that for the movie's purposes that had to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't understand it. Something else I don't understand. I thought these masks were like proprietary information and technology of the Impossible Mission Force.
Apparently some Russian dude can. And like he has a mask, whereas for the IMF, the mask machine shorted out. Yeah, it didn't work.
Everybody gets to wear a mask except Benji. What's up with that? So the team regroup and everyone's arguing.
Yep. And this is where fucking Ethan calls out Brandt, by the way, too, in a pretty fun scene where he you know, Brandt's like fucking yelling about this shit. And he's like, we just gave nuclear launch codes to a terrorist and this is awful. And I can't believe you guys did this. And Ethan's like, oh, really? Analyst Brandt, and then he like reaches for his gun, and Brandt is basically like CQ sees him and gets the drop on him basically, and Ethan's like, "See, I knew it. Now we're not the only ones hiding secrets from people, are we, Agent Brandt?"
I'm with Moreau, Jane.
She couldn't help us with
that. Yeah, so let's throw her off the building.
I didn't throw her.
Let's throw her off the building. She was not the mission, Jane. The mission was to track the file back to Hendrix, who is in the wind!
And how the hell did the Russians find us?
What are you asking me for?
Because your communications, you're in charge of covering our tracks.
I'm sorry, you cannot afford to make mistakes like that now, Benji. You're not a technician anymore. You're a field agent.
And you're just an analyst. Right? Right?
Who are you really, Brandt? What are you asking? What am I asking? All right, let me see if I can put it another way. How does an agent with skills like that end up an analyst?
Well, we all have our secrets. Tell me, Ethan.
You tell me yours, I'll tell you mine. Friends in the region. Just sit tight. I'll send someone to get you out of here.
What about Hendrix? What's the plan?
The plan was for us to stop him together.
Well, what are you gonna do?
Change the plan.
Wait, that's it?
What are we gonna do? Go after him alone?
Would you care to explain yourself, Agent Brandt?
I was on a protection detail in Croatia, shadowing the assets,
husband and wife. They were never supposed to know we were there. Whole thing's routine. It was a milk run. 3 days in, we caught wind that a Serbian hit squad was after our couple. But my team had it under control. You knew we were coming. But I couldn't shake this feeling that I should warn the couple somehow. I wanted to find a way to let them know. But, you know, orders are orders, so I didn't. One day, my husband decides to leave the hotel and go for a run, so I follow him. And I leave two men with a wife. When I get back, my guys are unconscious and the wife is gone. Local police found her body 3 days later. What was left of her, anyway. That was my last day in the field. I couldn't face another life or death situation after that.
So what happened to the husband?
Never saw him again. Until 2 days ago in Moscow, when the secretary introduced me to Ethan Hunt.
No, that's not what happened. She left him.
Yeah. I heard that one too, Benji. But unfortunately, I was there. Just like I was there when the secretary got the phone call that Ethan was in custody for killing six Serbian nationals in cold blood.
An unsanctioned hit.
Yeah.
Disavowed.
Next thing I know, I'm on a plane to Dubai. Wondering the whole time, do I tell him? How do I tell him that I'm responsible? I could have warned him. I should have warned him. But I didn't. And she died.
I remember that being in the trailer, and I thought like there was going to be like a much bigger revelation,
right?
than just so this guy went to the same training that all of us did,
right?
And now he's just an analyst. Okay, all right. This guy who is the exact same height and build as me is a trained field agent. Okay, all right, that's fine. But secrets come out.
Right.
So Ethan accuses Bran of keeping secrets from them as he is displayed his fighting skills, atypical of an analyst. While Ethan seeks more information from Bogdan, Brant admits that he was assigned as security detail to Hunt and his wife Julia while on assignment, unbeknownst to those two. According to Brant's story, Julia was killed by a Serbian hit squad, and Benji's like, nah, she divorced him. He's like, nah, that's not what happened. I saw it, but like kinda, but not really. But I know what I saw, so I saw it. And she was killed by a Serbian hit squad, prompting Ethan to pursue and kill the entire hit squad before he was caught by Russians and sent to prison, where he got a rock made of vibranium that he could throw around and hit three different corners and catch it with one hand.
And in the meantime, while this is going on, Ethan goes off to, like you said, meet up with Bogdan, who has an arms dealer cousin who yes. will be able to give Ethan information as to where Hendrix might be going.
And apparently that information is to India. They're going to India.
Yes. So here's something that I found super interesting that I realized about not just this film, but the franchise generally as a whole. There might be some exceptions, and Mission Impossible 1 is probably it. But for the rest of this film franchise, Mission Impossible series makes every city they go to look incredible.
Yeah.
Like Mumbai, I understand, is probably a pretty advanced city in India, and there's a lot of nice-looking portions of it, but I'm sure there's a whole lot more shitty-looking portions of Mumbai as well. But we don't get to see those. Instead, we get to see, like, this beautiful palace and the cityscape. And you saw the same thing in Moscow, which looks fucking out, like the coolest city on the fucking world when you see the you know, establishing shot. And of course, Dubai looks amazing because Dubai is a very, you know, technologically advanced city in the middle of the desert for some reason, but it's there. Whereas, like, I feel like the Bond franchise kind of gives you a more realistic look at a lot of cities. Like, they do show you some of the glamorous parts, but, like, Istanbul looks like fucking trash in From Russia with Love. Yeah. Like, it's not trying, like, in Goldfinger, one of the most popular Bond films, they go to Kentucky, and there's, like, not even, like, a special part of Kentucky. Like, at some point, Felix Leiter's driving down a highway, and you can see a KFC that he's driving by. So, like, I feel like that the Bond films are a little bit more realistic in their city portrayals, whereas Mission Impossible's like, every city looks amazing. Do you remember what Shanghai looked like in the last film? Holy shit, every city's like this, guys. Is your city not like this? Well, then you're not living in the right places.
Apparently. Look, when I went to Jamaica, we stayed at a resort, and it was incredibly nice, right? It was incredibly nice, and it was beautiful and all that. But you got to go through some shit to get there.
Yeah.
Like, it's not all, you know, the Mission Impossible franchise is, they like work with the tourism boards of all these cities, apparently. Right. You know what, which is fine. You know, I get it. Especially if you're like actually shooting there, you want to show the city some love. Yeah. But yeah, I do appreciate the Bond films for being a little more grounded in terms of like locale.
Now, it is also, so this Mumbai part is weird because we are fast approaching the climax of this film, but it doesn't feel like it. Like when they go to Mumbai, yeah, it kind of feels like they're just, this is the next step of the journey. Like we have to do this thing to do this thing. Like it doesn't feel like that we are reaching the ultimate confrontation. In this
movie. Yeah, when they go to Mumbai, this is the third act.
Right.
Like, this is the third act of the film. The second act of the film is everything in the desert, and then this is the third act. They're very clearly laid out, like, acts, but it doesn't feel like it, which I guess goes to the movie's pacing, because this is not a short movie.
No, and I think the reason why is because the second act of a film tends to usually be the longest act of a film. In this case, it's actually the shortest, because like you said, the entire Dubai sequence is essentially the second act of the film. And once they decide to go to Mumbai, that's what is definitely starts third act. But the second act is just like hyper compressed into this very small portion of the film.
Yeah. Hendrix facilitated the sale of a defunct Soviet military satellite to an Indian telecom entrepreneur. I don't know how to pronounce his first name, so I'm just going to pronounce his last name, Noth. which he like is it Bridge, Bridge?
I think it's Bridge, if I'm not mistaken.
Bridge, Mr. Nath.
He's essentially the Indian John Legere, essentially.
While Brant and Bryn and Benji infiltrate the server room to take it offline, Jane gets Nat to reveal the satellite override code. She's got to flirt with this dude.
Right.
And this dude is, you know, your stereotypical, you know, big shot who believes that like any woman in his purview, like, He is entitled to her, right?
And he tries to impress her by essentially acting like a rich asshole.
Yeah. He's essentially like, I don't want to see anybody with an empty hand. Get everybody a glass of whatever they want and do it right now. And they're like, yes, sir. And then he looks at her and is like, impressed yet? Like, wow. Wow, you're a douche, dude. But she's got to do like the honeypot thing to get the information. Meanwhile, Benji and Brant have to go into this server room in the most ridiculous way possible. Benji tells Brant he's got to wear this metal like endo suit and wear it underneath his clothes. And he's got to jump into this server room, which is located, I don't know, in some basement 25 feet underground. And Benji's like, yeah, but I'm going to have a rover with a magnet to like kind of keep you in place. You just got to jump down onto, and the only place you can jump down is on this vent that has a big old spike coming out from it.
Oh, I like how you're calling it a vent. That's a turbine, basically. That's the cooling, the main cooling source for the server that they're trying.
Yeah, that's how big this place is, right? Like it needs a turbine to keep it cool. And he's like, yeah, you're gonna wear this metal suit, but you can't be in there too long because, you know, like any computer, if you leave it on too much, it's going to get hot in there. And, you know, you don't want like fans and all that shit coming on. Like, you just want to get in there and get out. Right. So he eventually does it. Right.
Yeah, he jumps in there. Of course, he they're doing the obvious homage to the first Mission Impossible, where Tom Cruise is hanging in the fucking computer room and fucking Brandt is doing the same thing in this one. Just in case you weren't sure about their intentions for this character.
A lot of good that did.
Yeah, well.
he's fine. He's fine. He'll wield an archaic weapon in a couple superhero movies and make back.
Like I said, he was in the next film, and then I don't believe he was in Fallout, was he?
No, he wasn't.
Good riddance. Go be Hawkeye. I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm not a huge Jeremy Renner fan. I've seen him in maybe two movies that I'm like, wow, he's really good in this. And anything else, he just seems like a dickhead. Even if he's trying to play like someone genuine, like he just seems like a dickhead to me. So eventually, Carter is able to get this dude to give up the codes. Because this dude's thinking about his dick, and you know, guys,
they have this weird, like, I don't understand the flirtation that develops between it's this very weird thing where like she's making eyes at Tom Cruise and he sees her making eyes and he's like, ooh, I'm competing with another man. This is very cool. And she's like holding his hand. And when Brandt does the jump, like she like digs into his hand and that scares him away, but he liked it because then he's like calling her on a cell phone. You gotta come find me. Like, come track me down. But to get his attention, like Tom Cruise, like leans in and kisses her. It's a weird fucking whole ordeal. This scene, I don't quite get it. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I got it up until the point, where Tom Cruise kisses her.
Yeah.
And he sees it. And then it's like, oh, all right, well, she's taken by. Like, unless like he's so arrogant that he will, you know.
And I think that's what Ethan Hunt was trying to say. Because like before he kissed her, you know, he's like, don't hit me. I'm playing a hunch. And he kisses her. And then as soon as like he kisses her, like his butler comes up with a tray of cell phones. and gives her one of them. And it's this dude like, oh, like you are a ravishing, passionate creature, aren't you? And she's just like, yeah, whatever, I guess. And he's like, I'm hiding now. Let's play hide and seek. And it's weird. Like, it's fucking.
You're a super whore. Huh? You'll fuck anybody. Oh, they just got to come up to you, huh? Well, come find me then. All right.
But like you said, eventually she gets up to his bedroom. And they're like, all right, now you can beat the shit out of him and get the codes. And they get them just in time. But unfortunately, Hendrix at that point had disabled remote access to the satellite. So they had to go actually track him down now at this point because he's already initiated the launch sequence.
Yes, he's initiated the launch sequence from a Russian nuclear sub. In the Pacific, the submarine fires a nuke towards San Francisco. Ethan pursues Hendrix in a BMW concept car that overlays the map on the windshield, which is why this is a concept car and not put into mass production, because that is not a good idea.
Nope.
Do you have anything overlaying a windshield? Pay attention. That's all you really got to do. So Ethan is, everyone's fighting, right?
So they get to the TV station too late because the launch has already started. So now they have to try to abort the missile before it hits San Francisco. So they have to get the case that the launch was in it, initiated from, that has the abort thing in it. In the meantime, they had Wistrom ruined the server, basically, like the communication equipment. So they had to fix that too, because if that wasn't fixed, then the abort code, the signal could not be sent out to the missile. So they had to fix the connection to the satellite. So while Ethan was chasing down Hendrix with the case, Carter and then eventually Brant and Benji had to fight Wistrom, who cut the power to the broadcast station. So they not only had to repair the server, but they also had to get the power restored. And this is all happening at the same time, essentially.
Right. Now, while his team are trying to get the power back, Ethan is battling Hendrix for the case. Now, they're battling in what is... what I can only describe as a vertical car park that is kind of like a vending machine for cars. I've never seen one of these, but I do believe they're real, right?
They are. They actually make these now where you can buy cars from them as well. Like, they have these car parks that you essentially, like, they have new cars sitting in them, and you use an app to order the car that you want. And then you purchase it, and then the car just gets delivered to you at the car park thing, essentially.
This is a very, very unique location to have a final fight. And it's not just a final fight. It's a final fight of cat and mouse. They're both trying to get the MacGuffin.
Mm-hmm. Not even that. Hendrix isn't even trying to get it. He's just trying to. He's playing.
Right. He's just trying to prevent Tom Cruise from getting it.
Right.
It's more like cat and mouse, and it's actually kind of cool. It's very vertical, and you can feel the verticality of it. You can feel the visceral action, all the hits, Hendrix. By the end of this thing. he's beat up pretty bad, and by the end of it, this dude is truly insane. He's truly an anarchist, so much so that he's willing to die for what he believes in. So they are at a very high point in this car park, and Ethan is like, "Yo, give me that case, man." And Hendrix doesn't say anything. He grabs the case, he holds it tight, and then he just jumps off. He's just like, "Fuck you. I regret nothing." And he falls off, bounces on a car for good measure, and plummets to his death.
He's pretty dead. He's pretty dead. Like he doesn't die right away.
He doesn't die yet.
But he's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. And Ethan is like, "Yo, I really, really need to get this thing. What's the quickest way down?" A straight line, apparently.
Yeah.
And Ethan gets in one of these cars and just drives off head first and takes a 50-foot vertical drop in a car, hoping that the airbags will protect him. And because he's our main character, of course they will.
Yeah.
So he is doing that. The team are trying to get the power back on. Ethan opens the case and
crawls to it because he did just fall 100 feet in a head-on collision, essentially, and had an airbag deployed in his face. So he has to crawl out of the fucking car, crawl over to the case, open it up. There's about 30 seconds left before the missile makes landfall. So I'll let you take it from here.
And he crawls over and he opens it. He looks at the time. He raises his hand and he says, "Mission accomplished." And he hits the button and nothing happens.
Who was that for? Who was that for? Because as far as he knew, Hendrix was dead. Was that for him?
It's for his own edification.
Oh,
man.
My God.
It's for his own edification. Just like, fuck it. Like, fuck it. I'm such a badass. Mission accomplished. Oh, shit.
Right. So he's like, because they haven't gotten the server back online yet, because Brandt and Wistrom are fighting each other in the fuse room, basically, at the television studio. Eventually, Benji kills Wistrom, who is almost about to kill Brandt. They're able to get the power on. Carter puts the server, like whatever fucking bit she needs to put back in the computer to make the server go online. And then Ethan is able to abort the missile with like 1.5 seconds left. And it bounces off of a building in San Francisco and then, you know, falls harmlessly into the San Francisco Bay.
Not just any building, the Transamerica.
Oh, is that Transamerica building? Okay.
like a landmark in San Francisco, because, you know, Mission Impossible. And yeah, the day is saved. Huzzah.
As soon as this happens, basically the Spetsnaz guy comes into the car park, sees what's going on, sees Hendrix dead. Sees the case, sees that Ethan aborted the missile, realizes that they're fighting for the same cause, and basically outlines the plot point that all of us are wondering, like, why did Ethan send him here? And that's because he had to see it happen. Otherwise, he would never have believed that this had happened, essentially.
the day is saved. We cut to Seattle.
Weeks later,
and Ethan is having lunch or dinner with his good buddy, or having drinks with his good buddy, Luther Stickle, played by Ving Rhames.
And we come in on him telling the mission accomplished story. Like, why would you share that with anybody?
He probably did it, right, to this is so badass, I have to tell everyone how badass this is. And I got there and I took a car, like, yeah, and I drove off the cliff of the car park, yeah, and I fell 100 feet, yeah, but the airbag deployed and I was crawling. Really? I was crawling. And I get to the case, and then what'd you do? And then I yelled, mission accomplished, and then hit it. And they're like, wait, what? You actually said mission accomplished
out loud.
And it was like, look, you're the same, you're still the same corny old Ethan, man, but you know what, you're good enough to have at a barbecue. So everybody kind of comes in. Tom Cruise gives everybody new assignments, you know, because we're a team now, guys. And Benji's like, yeah, we're a team. And Paula Patton's like, yeah, we're a team, but not really, because I'm out. And Brandt is like, I would love to be a team, but there's something you got to know. It was my fault that your wife's dead. And he's like, how do you know she's dead? He's like, because I synced it. And no, you ain't synced nothing. She's alive, bro. She's right over there. But don't point. Don't look. Don't look. She's right there, but don't look. And you know, like, no, everything's cool, bro. So see you in the next movie. It's like, all right, I'll see you in the next movie. And we see Ethan give a look over to his wife, played by Michelle Monaghan. And you know, they're like, yeah, I'll see you when it's safe. It's like, you just, you know, don't date anybody, don't sleep with anybody until two movies from now. And but yeah, and then Ethan gets his next mission,
right?
And
there's a mysterious entity called the Syndicate that's causing all kinds of trouble.
Yeah,
we'll have to pick that up in the next film.
Yeah, the Spectre. I mean, the Syndicate is causing trouble. And we got to find out what in the next movie. So, yeah, I like this movie. It's fun. This is where this movie hits its stride. This franchise hits its stride with this movie. As a matter of fact, the next three films are pretty much a trilogy, whereas the first three were kind of disparate stories that really the only thing keeping them together is the fact that Tom Cruise is in them.
I mean, the only reason, though, that this could be considered part of a trilogy is only because they set up the next film in the dying embers of this one. Like, there really isn't anything to do with the other films.
No, not really, but in the sense that the look and feel of the movie is you know, similar to the look and feel of these three movies are very similar, whereas the first three movies are just kind of all over the place.
Right.
But yeah, I like this movie, man. I like this movie. A couple months from now, we'll do what is, in my opinion, the best of the franchise. And any parting words?
Not about this film. Like I said, I think it's only diminished in my eyes because, again, we're about to embark on the greatest Mission Impossible film, bar none.
Yeah.
So I think if this film had a better, more charismatic villain, who had more screen time, it might be more memorable. I think that the problem with this film is you get too much IMF, you get too much Tom Cruise, and not enough of stuff happening around the main plot. Like, I'm trying to think of a point of stuff in the movie that he's not directly involved in, and there's not a lot. Like, if it's not him in the scene, it's his team doing something on a mission that he's also on.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah. The Bond movies do a very good job of making their villains memorable. Mm. This one in particular doesn't really do it. None of these movies are known for their villains,
I would disagree. Like, the next one, I think the villain is very, very notable. And also in the last one too, in three, Davian was certainly a major presence, in the film.
I think this franchise is way more focused on the impossible missions.
I would agree, right? That's probably the case.
Yeah. Whereas as the Bond movies are, you know, a lot of their characters are memorable to me. The set pieces are the things that I remember from these movies. Which is why I can love both of them. And you should too, cause they're all great.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a premium member. Because you are a premium member, you have access to this show, and a host of others, including the airing of grievances, the Seinfeld podcast that I do with Jay, Look Forward, the political podcast that Jay, Andy, and sometimes Brad, do on occasion. That show is amazing, by the way. You really should be listening to that. That is you get the full 2, sometimes 3 hours of political commentary, in a way that only we can deliver it to you. If you enjoy what you hear, tell your friends and subscribe, and, that's it.
So, keep an eye on the TNP Studios fan group, the regular fan group, because we're going to be asking for your help again soon, because the next episode that we are doing is we're doing a tournament of title songs for the James Bond film franchise. We are going to get the definitive Men with the Golden Tongues list of the best to worst title songs throughout the James Bond film franchise. This is going to be very interesting, possibly even more interesting. One of the most interesting ones we've done so far, because as we all know, the title song doesn't always necessarily line up. The quality of the song doesn't always necessarily line up with the quality of the film that it portrays.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious to see how you guys help us determine the initial seeds. And I'll be even more curious to see how me and Micah go in this one, because here's the thing about this. Like, oftentimes Micah and I will agree on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, not now.
Yeah, I was gonna say music taste though wildly different between people. So this is going to be very interesting to see what happens when we get together to discuss a completely subjective topic.
Yeah, this is going to be, as they say, a barn burner.
and we're going to need to think of an actual, like, real tiebreaker situation, because I have a feeling that we might run into more than our normal share of them in this episode.
Yeah. Might need to bring a third party in just to be a tiebreaker. I don't know. We'll see. But thank you for listening, and the men with the golden tongues will return.
Mission accomplished!